Check. 1, 2. Okay, so hello everyone. My name is Stephen Downs from the National Research Council of Canada, Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada. It's a pleasure to be here in Banff for the Open Education Conference. And it's also a pleasure to welcome the people who are listening on audio later. Hi, audio people. It is April 23, 2015. So, I want you to think of open educational resources not in the typical way of thinking of open educational resources like textbooks or assignments or course guides or whatever. I want you to think of them as though they are words in a conversation. So the way you use the word apple right now, think of an open educational resource being used in that way. So, you know, if I say, I want some apples, you would say, I want some, insert OER. So, why would I ask this? I want you to think about how these words are used in education. We can go back to traditional education. We can go back to the days of the 50s and the 40s and whatever, when we had lectures much like this room, and the presentation was in a series of words. Words were our primary teaching medium at that time. Sure, there were some pictures and bad overheads, but mostly it was words. And the words fulfilled very specific purposes. They were mostly, almost entirely uttered by the instructor. They did things like, well, what did they do? They set objectives. They gave examples, they established criteria, the usual sorts of educational tasks. But if we think of words in this context as educational resources, we're limiting our perspective as to what can be done with words. We're limiting our use of words to the statement of objectives and the serving of educational purposes. We're limiting our use of words to having educational content, whatever that might mean. And of course, there are many discussions about what constitutes educational content and what does not. We're limiting our words to the performance of one of Gagne's tasks, say, attracting attention, establishing objectives, performing an assessment, etc. We're limiting our pedagogy to a pedagogy of knowledge transfer because that's what you do with words in a traditional academic setting. The instructor has knowledge in his or her mind, usually his, it's the 50s, right? And this knowledge is transferred into you, the students, and you will later on repeat it. The students in this picture are rendered essentially mute. Now, we know in education in the decades since then that we can do a lot more with words than just that. And educational theory has transformed itself over the last few decades. And words began to be used more broadly. They began to be used in a conversation, for example. They began to be used to interrogate. The student could ask how something works. The student could ask why something works. The student could ask how and why this topic is being raised in this environment, in this domain, in this subject. And that leads to an overall environment, an overall learning environment, where words and knowledge are the product not only of the individual, not only of the professor, but of the community as a whole, and where knowledge is not simply created by that community, but also, if you will, reified by that community, put into concrete, socially established form. And there are many ways of doing that. We've done that with words. What we have not done that with is open educational resources. And indeed, if we looked at open educational resources, many people, when they looked at the definition of open educational resources, as, for example, in the UNESCO documents, everybody focuses on the first part of the definition and openness and sharing and licensing and all the good stuff, and not so much the last sentence of the definition. OERs range from textbooks to curricula, syllabi, lecture notes, assignments, tests, projects, audio, video, and animation. It's a very limited picture. If you applied this to words, you would say something like, where did 90% of our use of words go? It's gone. And we have a very narrow, limited scope. So what happens when you think of open educational resources as words? That's the topic of this presentation. I'm going to talk about how we can deconstruct and understand open educational resources, how we can use them in the representation of our knowledge and our understanding, and how we move from that understanding to thinking of a new perspective, probably in my mind a better perspective of open educational resources, where students are the authors, students are the creators, whoever students may be. And by students, really what I mean is people. And I'm going to do this in the context of the Learning and Performance Support Systems Program, which we are running at the National Research Council. As I describe these three things, I'm describing aspects of the architecture of the software that we're developing. So, when we deconstruct sentences, we're going back to words now, right? This is the typical way of doing it. This is, as an aside, the correct way of doing it. That was a linguistic joke. Never mind. So we analyze a simple sentence into, for example, subject, predicate, object. And of course, a complex sentence can involve much more, brings in many more concepts, quantification. It brings in prepositions, placement, location, time, agency, and so on. I could list a wide range of concepts. And indeed, interestingly and arguably, the structure of language is, in one perspective, the structure of our conceptual framework. Now, of course, if we're limited to words, we're limited to a fairly narrow conceptual framework, but we think of more than words. So as humans, we have a much wider conceptual framework. But I don't need to linger on that. Online media does all of this, but more. And I like using a tweet because when Twitter produces tweets, if you look behind the scenes, you look at the JSON representation of a tweet, you see all kinds of interesting metadata, but you can actually see it right in the ordinary presentation of a tweet. You have not just the sentence and all the linguistic elements of the sentence, but you have things like author, nickname for the author, which actually says a lot, date, geotag, conversational reference, hashtag, and so on. So what happens in social media is we can analyze not only the internal structure of the representation, but we can also see this representation as it exists in a wider social context. That's really interesting. As we move beyond tweets, we move to the world of, well, things like lolcats and internet memes and all of these things. I just love these things. And again, in their analysis, right, they're composed of a picture. You can't really see, but there's two green eyes in there. That's a cat. And then there are the words. I has idiosyncratic conjugate, whatever. And it's interesting because the pictures will often adhere to various archetypes and conventions. The language will adhere to various archetypes and conventions. This is in cat pidgin English, which is wonderfully named. And the lolcat exists in a social and technical context. And what's really interesting is a person with the appropriate experience and background looks at this and they see not just the picture, not just the words, but all kinds of messages. And you've all seen, you know, the classic picture, right? And then, you know, Harper's Budget. I'm just kidding. I have to remember who I work for. So, this, taken all together, and this slides really nicely into the previous presentation, this is where conversation happens, right? Conversation happens online, on the internet, in social media. The same sort of thing that happened with words in learning is now happening with these new artifacts, with Flickr posts, with lolcats, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, and a whole pile of other things. And we're interested, aren't we, in what these conversations contain. Look at the example we just got of lawyers doing their preparation work for court cases. See, I was listening. I wasn't finishing my presentation. Right? And they're practicing. And that practice is really interesting. That practice, that going back and forth, that visible development of capacity from being really nervous at first to actually engaging, I didn't like the word combat, but engaging in debate later, that is observable, measurable, and describable. It's part of the social and learning context of an online communication. And it's something, it's the sort of thing we can do much more of in the internet context than we could in the traditional word-based educational context. So that constitutes the first part of our technology. The first part of the technology is what we call the resource repository network. And, you know, it draws its inspiration from the days of RSS and content syndication and all of that. People who know me know I've been spending a lifetime at this. All the different places where these conversations happen. It's a little small to read because there are many places. Email, RSS, Open Archives Initiative, SharePoint, Facebook, Twitter, Monster, government sources, repository, Desire to Learn. I figured I'd give them a plug. Coursera. Well, okay, not so much a plug. EdX, et cetera, right? All of these are in different formats that contain different metadata. We bring them in, we smoosh them, we parse them, we scrape them, we do analytics on them. Importantly and essentially, this happens in a personal context. This is, as an aside, the problem with data analytics. You can't do it in a personal context. You have to have the personal context in order to understand what was said. Think back to the lolcat. If you just did a big data analysis of a lolcat, you missed the joke. And then what we do is, through this analysis, we produce sets or a set of different types of entities. Articles, photographs, videos, persons, authors, publishers, etc. Job opportunities, competencies, certificates, events. All of these are, if you will, things that we find in online communication. But really, really importantly, don't want to miss this, almost off the bottom of the slide, just because of the way this presents itself. Because I don't know why it's showing. Why is it showing all that? Oh, well. Relations. The relations between these things. This author created this video. This organization published this photograph. This certificate shows that this person has this competency. So we want to, when we're looking at these resources, analyze what they say, not simply in terms of sentences, but in terms of what we call a graph. And that takes us to the second part of the presentation. Understanding the knowledge itself. Again, education has shifted. We've gone from what Paulo Freire says, that's him, is the banking theory of education, where we just try to take content and pile it on and just remember a whole bunch of stuff to, well, what? We're going from knowing a pile of facts to, well, what? A lot of people will offer different approaches. They'll talk about the constructivist approach, where we're creating models or representations, where we're building meaning, where we're putting things into context. But typically, and there's a whole big aside here that I can't get into, typically the way they think of it is, it's a whole bunch of sentences with rules and principles and things like that. It looks like, they think, the inside of a computer. But the inside of a computer isn't the same as the inside of a person. And this is really important to understand. We look at it as a graph. When this information, when this content comes in, both into our system and also into the person themselves, what is happening is they're creating, like I said, a whole bunch of entities and then all of the relations connecting these entities. So in LPSS, underlying the system is not your typical learning management system structure of courses, books, libraries of OER resources, things like that. Oh, sure, there may be a library of artifacts over there, but the core of what we're building is a graph database. And we're not trying to build one big graph database for all of humanity, because that would be ridiculous. What we are building is one specific individual graph for each person. In our system, each person has their own instance. We call it an LPSS instance of the system. Inside that system, all the stuff that they've read, all the stuff that they've looked at, everything they've aggregated is added to this graph database. This graph database is a representation of their knowledge. So, why do we do that? Well, there's always a lot of discussion about quality of open educational resources, right? And it's interesting that the discussion of quality of open educational resources always refers back to this whole educational agency thing, where we're trying to fulfill some kind of learning purpose. So accuracy, really important, right? You don't evaluate your conversations that well, it might pass your mind, but when you're having a conversation, you're having a conversation. You're not sitting there saying, is this sentence accurate? Is this sentence, can I trust it? Reputation of author or institution. I don't even want to get into that. Standard of technical production, like that matters. Accessibility, that does matter, but not for everyone, right? Me, I need bigger print, not, oh, I don't have my schedule of conference with the Texas. but obviously not everyone needs that. Fitness for purpose, yeah, sure, but everyone's in different circumstances. Learning takes place in context, the conversational context. The value of a resource is, does it fit into this context? Is it part of this network? Is it created by people you know? Is it created by people you trust, that you've connected with? Does it speak to what you're doing now? There's a whole mess of things that has everything to do with what you're doing now and almost nothing to do with traditional educational purpose. When we're evaluating OERs, we're looking at almost the exact wrong thing. So, two parts of the model. The aggregation of content, the graph representation of the database. I could say so much more, but I won't. Let's go back to how open educational resources really began. Well, okay, they didn't really begin with the Khan Academy, but kind of gets the concept right, because open educational resources, the way we think of them now, they're produced by academic institutions, often at great cost. They're publications, they're supposed to have beautiful videos and things. Really, they could be really ugly drawings in white on black backgrounds. I don't know what he was thinking. But even further, my first open educational resource was a thing called the Guide to the Logical Fallacies. I wrote it in 1995, and it was a study guide for some students. And that's how they began. They began not as formal academic productions. They began as people writing notes to support each other. And if we fail to understand this, we have failed to understand the purpose, origin, and mechanism of open educational resources. Now, our project focuses in particular on performance support. Performance support takes place during the event. Now, there are aspects of performance support. Preparing for scenario-based learning. Again, this is, you know, doing the arguments ahead of time. This is doing the flight simulator, you know, crash the plane in the computer, not in the real world, please. Then, you know, the last-minute refresher, the demonstration you do, the rehearsal you do before you go into the meeting, then point-of-need support, like my slides as I give a talk. Really handy to have that, because otherwise I'd have to remember and memorize this whole thing. And then after, really crucial, really important, the review, the reflection. And that's when most open educational resources actually get created, just after the heat of the moment. When you realize, first of all, whether your previous resources worked, and secondly, that you have a new insight, a new observation that you can create and share. So both of these things are happening in the reflection. The evaluation, the actual real evaluation of other resources and the creation of your own. Hey, here's a nice model. It's not exactly the way I do it, but it's nice, and I borrowed it because I could. It was online. And the idea, right, here comes the knowledge and here it is, blah, 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 performance support. And out of performance support comes user-generated content. That's where our open educational resources are created. As an aside, how much of that are we doing with all of our projects? The concept is sometimes known as working out loud. The idea of sharing what you're doing as you're doing it. I have a great picture of people in a hospital. They might even be a bit later with, you know, video camera. It's the black box recording in an aircraft. Or even better, Channel 9 on aircraft in the U.S., you can listen to the pilot flight communications. You're just sitting there, and it's the pilot in the control tower, and you listen to that. I've 4-hour flight listening to just that. So this creates a context for a personal assistant for learning. This is a diagram from Advanced Distributed Learning. It's the U.S. Government Military Learning Development Agency. But the idea here is to create a personal assistant for learning, which presents the resources in context, but also gives you the mechanism and means to comment on and add back to the environment that you're working in. We've taken that kind of approach and focused specifically on the personal. Again, why the personal? Because we're doing a graph. Because the graph database represents a person's experience of the world. So we have what we call the personal learning record. Personal learning record contains things like the activity record, for example, represented in a format called XAPI, or the Experience API. Really, that's just a whole bunch of subject, verb, object type sentences. It'll grow over time to include quantification, prepositions, and all the rest. But we have that. But we also have portfolio, artifacts, and evidence, the whole personal production side of things. That's what becomes OERs. So as you're learning, as you're doing things, you create things, you have conversations, those go out into the world, those become the learning resources for the next group of people. And then also, very important, badges, certificates, credentials, competencies. So this is created from all of this. This goes back into the individual and personal graph. And all of this combined creates the output, which is the open educational resource. Well, there's a whole world of evidence out there that this is actually what happens. This is what I produced in 5 minutes this morning because I was running out of time. But, you know, Stack Overflow for programming, D DeviantArt, WebMD kind of commercial, but still the same sort of idea. Vegan black metal chef. And, of course, here's my creating a live open educational resource. Now, of course, this is probably a few years old now. You'd use a GoPro, right? But, you know, it raises a lot of issues, and it points to the need for this to be personal learning resources. It raises issues of privacy. It raises issues of security. I work in a government context, right? So a lot of the people we work with can't just be sharing openly. It relates to issues of control and even licensing. And a significant part, significant effort on the part of the open education community needs to address how we can preserve and promote the integrity of personal information and personal learning while at the same time promoting the sharing of these resources to create this open educational resource infrastructure. We can't leave it to Facebook or Coursera or any of these others because, first of all, they'll get the information wrong. They're, and it's not a criticism. It's criticism of the method. They're generalizing over data that applies to everyone, so very broadly, and only from one particular environment, the Facebook environment or the LMS environment. We want to focus on very deep knowledge of an individual across multiple environments. And you can see how that's going to produce very different analytics, but it really does raise the question of privacy and security. The only way to do that is with a personal learning environment. I'll wrap up very briefly, very, very briefly, with some quick case studies of what we're doing in the LPSS program. Of course, we began with the Massive Open Online course, and for the record, because it has to be said, we invented the Massive Open Online course in 2008. But you notice, it's a graph. So we've been working on this graph representation concept of courses and knowledge since then. And we've learned a lot about how it works. We've learned a lot about how not to design your systems. The aggregator called Grasshopper that was used to support these courses was also the prototype for the LPSS aggregator that we've built, we continue to build. Plurn, something none of you have heard of, was a two-year internal project that we ran at NRC. I love the name. Personal Learning Environment and Resource Network. Plurn. And the people who use it are plurners. And what are you doing? I'm plurning.
And where are the people teaching the
plurners? Yeah, the plurners. So anyhow, nobody else liked the name. I got to understand. But we dug in. We did a lot of work on the underside of the MOOC environment. In Grasshopper, Grasshopper creates a graph as it goes along. It's not a good graph, I wrote it, but we learned a lot about how important the graph is to understanding the conversations and the educational activities that are taking place in a learning environment. We did a project, and Papa Yoga Dieng, who spoke yesterday, referred to it, for the Organisation Internationale de la Francophonie on open learning resources for, it was a MOOC. We did it with the University of Manitoba. It was delivered entirely in French. We learned a lot about delivering entirely in French, especially when most of us are English. That was a challenge. But it was definitely worth doing. And you really understand working in cross-cultural context that you cannot generalize across instances, across cultures, or across people. The way we had to approach the subject in French was very different than the way we approach it in English, and I got lots of criticisms for literal translations. And okay, fair enough, I get that. Another project still ongoing PCO stands for Privy Council Office. We're doing an internal project, internal government project with them, whereby we're working on the professionalization of aspects of the civil service through the use of badges. And the challenge here is the badges are earned in an environment that's inside the intranet, and we want to be able to display them in a person's backpack outside the intranet. And so this project explored ways and means of doing that. And like I said, we're continuing. Related to that is something called On Guard. On Guard is an infrastructure that has been set up for Canadian military and security systems to share techniques and knowledge. So it would be shared by the RCMP, by CSIS, by the different branches of the Canadian military, by the Defense Research, DRDC, I always forget what they stand for, the Coast Guard, anybody involved in security and safety. And the problem with them is they all have their own networks. They're super secure. So if we set up an environment in a military environment, nobody else can use it. So it's really hard to share and exchange and so on. So we have the environment. It's been going for a few years. It's been incorporated into LPSS, has a Moodle installation, a Mahara installation, and communication takes place using ELG, and we're using it as a prototype instance of LPSS. Another project we did was with the Arab League Educational, Cultural, and Scientific Organization. This was to explore the use of MOOCs and personal learning to develop awareness and understanding of Arab culture and to promote literacy in the Arab world. So they have their Arab for Natives and Non-Natives program that they were very interested in, and also capacity building. We did a review and an overview for them. That project currently on hold, awaiting funding, but we hope to resume it at some point. It was really interesting. And again, yeah, talk about cross-cultural lessons. You can't simply take a Canadian MOOC and apply it in an Arab world. Individual context matters. Personal context matters. The individuals in that room looked at the world very differently. Mobile interactive trainer. This was something that we've done for police forces. It speaks to the simulation side of thing, the scenario building side of thing. We have basically their firearms. The firearms are equipped. They're not real firearms. We don't play with real firearms. We're not interested in that. I'm not anyways. But they have little different colored lasers. They use them for police simulations. And the thing that we're doing with those is you have multiple people in the same environment, which is important. It's a realistic environment so that they actually, you know, they have to feel is right. And as they're working with them, they're sending information back into our system. So we have not yet, but we have planned to convert this information feeding back into the system into XAPI and represent these as learning activities. And why this is important is a person's experience using firearms is in the same environment as their philosophy course. And you might think, why does that matter? Well, I don't know. But it might. And we would never discover whether it mattered unless we did that. Similarly with medical simulations, this is one of our staff, Dee Jang, working on 2SIM. She's doing, as you can see, brain surgery on a fake brain. And again, representing learning activities in XAPI and feeding it in. So we could have in the same environment your philosophy course, your firearms training, and your practice doing neurosurgery. Something very recent, this just launched just a few weeks ago, Concierge Open Marketplace Solutions. We're connecting here job openings, small and medium-sized enterprise, federal government funding projects, experts and expertise and competencies all into a single environment. So that's a mess. This is the first version of it, and it connects the experts, the small and medium-sized enterprises, and the funding sources The second part of it will create personal learning environments, LPSS instances, for all the experts, all the people involved in the system in order to build this graph database. And this is, as an aside, why the graph database is so useful. We didn't know when we started that we wanted listings of experts, listings of job openings and all that. So a whole bunch of entities that we couldn't have predicted ahead of time. If we were using a traditional database representation, we'd have to scrap our database and start over. We're using a graph, we just add more entities and give them different properties. So it becomes very flexible. How to engage if you're a company in working on performance support, we'd love to talk to you to see how we can help you in your workplace. If you're an educational institution, we're looking at putting you in as part of the resources that are harvested and made accessible to people through their own instance of an LPSS. We want to understand better how that works, how to integrate formal learning with this informal method of personal learning and research support. If you're an educational technology company, parts of this will be available for licensing to put into your own projects. If you're in open education, you're an open education organization, you produce software or things like that that we can integrate, we're interested in that. If you're a funder, we would love to speak to you so that we can get large elements of this system into open education, make them freely available, and support the production and distribution of open educational resources worldwide. That's me, that's my presentation, and thank you very much for your time and attention.
We have 3 minutes for questions. May I?
Of course. No, you can't. Someone else. <I'm> just... Go ahead.
Thanks. It's a grand presentation. I have a little concern, which is that when we map, we reduce relationships to A is related to point B to related to point C. And my view of learning is it's emotional experience. If you think about how students get very anxious before an exam or a test, I'm not sure that charts so well in a digital kind of two-dimensional environment. Is there a way of capturing the emotional component of learning?
That's interesting. Now, just to be clear, we do not want to replicate pre-exam anxiety. But we do have a number of commercial projects that I didn't list there. One of them involves the exploration of emotions as they are represented in multimedia, but in social networks, etc. There's a range of projects around the idea of sentiment analysis, understanding not just what something says, not what somebody means, but how they're feeling, what emotions they're projecting when they're communicating into the larger world. You're right. You reduce everything to relations, you're going to miss something. Anytime you reduce things to a model, you lose some of the detail. And I have to remind people over and over and over again, the model is not the reality. The model will never be the reality, right? And so this isn't a substitute for human thought. This is an assistant. It's like, you know, I don't want to say it's like a prosthetic, but it's like a prosthetic. Okay, bad example. But so, you know, the person is going to have emotional reactions. They may be captured. They may remain private. I don't discount their importance. At the same time, I want to be careful about attempting to represent them. That's a terrible answer. I'm sorry. That was a really terrible answer, but that was the best I could come up with.
All right. We're out of time.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, everyone.